GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit jltus.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Merry Christmas and happy holidays. That's me. I serve as host of GreenSense.
I'm Bob Kessler, executive producer, and yes, Merry Christmas, happy holidays, everybody.
And each week, Bob and I search the globe to introduce you to people that are changing the world and making it a better place to live with their sustainable ideas and innovations.
We're kind of like Santa Claus flying all around the world. Well, here's who we got this week. Chris Higgins, who's a regular contributor. We'll have a look back at urban agriculture 2016. City sidewalks, busy sidewalks. Those streetlights can be powered by people's footsteps. That's happening in Las Vegas. And also, you know what? We talk a lot about water. That's a big, big issue. But a big source of water could be the oceans, and we got to figure out better ways to desalinate. So we'll learn about that.
GreenSense starts up this week with Chris Higgins of Urban Ag News for our Growing Green regular feature on urban agriculture. Chris, welcome to GreenSense.
Thank you, Robert, and thanks for having me again, and Merry Christmas.
Chris, being at the end of the year, I thought it's a great idea to take a look back in the year 2016 and look at three of the top trends in agriculture.
Well, for me, the three of the things that come to mind are, number one, organics and how they are how organics may play a role in the future of controlled environment agriculture in urban areas. Number two is that, you know, what's trending with the vertical farming and where we're at in the development of this new technology and new space in regards to urban agriculture. And then third is one that we have never spoken about together, but it's the impact of the new laws that are being passed on a state-by-state basis for recreational cannabis and the pros and cons that that's having on the urban agriculture industry.
Well, Chris, since we haven't talked about the last one, why don't we do that one first?
Yeah, so as most people are probably aware, because it's all over the news, and it seems like you can't get away from it with different exposés on CNN or Discovery Channel, whatever it may be, is that recreational cannabis laws are popping up in a wide variety of states. From the East Coast to the West Coast. There's also the addition of the medical marijuana laws as well. This is having an impact on urban agriculture, and this is both a positive and a negative impact. Starting with the negative side is that there's a demand for labor. So now we have a lot of new jobs being created, and there's a need for these new jobs to be qualified professional horticulture positions. And so now that's a fairly small group of professionals here in the United States. And so now we're all competing for the same labor. The second part of that is actually a positive. Because the crop is high value, this is an area where there's an opportunity to drive and create new technology that can then be funneled down to those of us growing food in controlled environment agriculture facilities.
Yes, we're really seeing the crunch that the marijuana industry is created on the labor force. So that's a topic that we'll have to cover in much more depth in preceding interviews. Let's talk a little bit about organic. As I said in past discussions on this, this is a confusing area for the public. What are you seeing as the biggest trend in organic?
So the biggest trend on the farming side is that the National Organic Standards Board met in St. Louis in November. And there is a growing likeliness that those in urban agriculture or controlled environment agriculture using hydroponic production methods will no longer be able to certify themselves as organic. Now, as we talked about in a past episode, that's really an argument of science and philosophy, which is a very difficult argument to have. But I would say that your comment about confusion at the consumer level continues. And we're talking about arguments between science and philosophy. And just last night, I received a phone call from a friend of mine who's a medical doctor concerned with what she's feeding her children. And she's concerned that she's not using enough are purchasing enough organic products. So we went through the whole thing, telling her to trust her understanding of science and understanding of what benefits organics truly have versus the philosophy behind why we should be using organics.
Well, we have just a few seconds left, so let's hit the topic that's close and dear to my heart, that's indoor vertical farming. What are you seeing as the trend there?
The trend in vertical farming is it's still, you know, an area of an area of farming that is receiving a lot of attention from the media, but it's still a very immature space. And what we saw in 2016 was we saw maybe not as many new farms open up, but we did see a lot of the vertical farms that were first to market expand in their production space. So looking forward into 2017, my expectations is that the consumer is going to see more product grown in vertical farms at their grocery store, which is I think great for this new burgeoning industry.
Chris, my old friend, I wish you a Merry Christmas and a happy holidays and a very prosperous new year, and look forward to having a great 2017 with continuous updates on urban agriculture.
Thanks again, and Merry Christmas to you and the team at GreenSense.
That's Chris Higgins of Urban Ag News and our look back at 2016. I'm Robert Colangelo. This is GreenSense.
StartEngine has raised millions for green companies selling shares directly to the general public. GreenSense Farms has raised close to $500,000 and Elio Motors close to $17 million. If you need capital for your business, go to startengine.com and start raising the money you need.
Those city sidewalks, busy sidewalks we hear about in the Christmas classic Silver Bells, could be used as a renewable energy source. Engo Planet recently installed in Las Vegas the world's first streetlights powered by human footsteps. Here to tell us more is Engo Planet CEO, Peter Mirovich. Peter, welcome to GreenSense.
Thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations on the installation in Las Vegas. I was recently there and I was amazed at how many people are focused on making Las Vegas sustainable. How much of a stretch of road has these new human-powered streetlights?
Well, this was a pilot project with only four streetlights that we installed at this phase. City of Las Vegas wanted to test our technology to see how much energy can produce, to see what kind of lightning we can deliver. And we installed this in the end of September. This pilot is going to last probably 6 to 8 months before we get back from them. And after that, they are planning to deploy this technology in many other locations in the city, also in some remote areas where they don't have access to power, which our solution is a very good solution for those kind of areas. So we are definitely looking forward to work with them in the future on different projects.
Peter, what is your measure of success? When you're finished with this pilot project, how do you know it was successful?
Well, for the Las Vegas project particularly, we have a very important task to achieve, and that is to see how the battery will sustain the desert heat, as you know, that Las Vegas has. As you know, heat is very dangerous for the battery. It can completely destroy and lower the life of the battery. So that's some area that we are particularly looking in this project, is how the battery will sustain the heat and all other weather conditions. And that's a task that City of Las Vegas actually put us as the main priority.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how these streetlights work. Explain how they convert people's footsteps into energy to create light.
Absolutely. So each Engo Planet streetlight is equipped with solar panels on the top of the pole and kinetic energy tiles that are embedded into the pavement nearby each pole. A kinetic energy tile harvests energy from pedestrians' footsteps at the moment, but in the future it will harvest energy from vehicles' movement. Think about highways, roads, etc. Beneath each kinetic surface, there is a microgenerator that convert mechanical energy to electricity every time somebody step on that or car or trucks passes over that. All that energy is then generating and storing into the batteries, and combined with the solar energy, Engel Planet streetlight represent a completely energy independent solution that can provide not just lightning but also Wi-Fi, power the cameras, many sensors that harvest outdoor data, etc. In the future, we plan to power possibly a charging station for electric vehicles and many other different features.
Well, I have to ask an obvious question. You need light at night when the sun doesn't shine, and few people are walking on the streets, except in Las Vegas, the city that never sleeps. So how do you power the lights when you don't have kinetic human power or solar source?
Well, the main reason why that is the main benefit of our solution is that we diversified the energy sources. We didn't want to rely just on one source, such as solar or kinetic. Then we wanted to combine these two sources in order to have diversification. We do have the battery, so we, even if we don't have any footsteps, any activity of pedestrians or vehicles, and if we don't have sun for, let's say, 6 days, we will still have the energy independence for those 6 to 7 days, because the battery system that we designed will give us that much independence.
This is Green Sense. I'm Robert Colangelo, and my guest is Engel Planet CEO Peter Mirovich, who is making some interesting streetlights powered by walkers. Per your website, the annual energy costs for streetlights are about $40 billion per year and create 100 million tons of carbon pollution. It's a lot of pollution each year. While your streetlights run on their own, what about installation and maintenance costs?
Yes, absolutely. The maintenance cost for standard and traditional streetlights that many cities currently have is approximately $200, which is a lot. If you count, for example, New York City has 250,000 traditional streetlights. Count that times 200, that's a really big expenditure for the city. Our solution and our streetlight doesn't require that much maintenance because it's completely energy independent. And the only maintenance that we currently need to pay attention is that a solar panel has to be cleaned from the dust at least twice a year. Other than that, battery is maintenance free. It has to be replaced. We recommend every 5 to 7 years. But other than that, it's really maintenance free and we dramatically lower the cost for the city and to the end client.
Many green ideas have a high upfront capital investment that gets paid back through reduced operating costs to make it economical. What's the upfront cost of your lights, and what's the payback time?
Well, yes. As you know, I just want to mention one data. Last year, $285 billion were invested in renewable energy projects. This huge and rapid growth in renewable energy projects drive the economic of scales, which dramatically lowers the price of main components such as solar panels, battery, and controllers, which provide the end price much more appealing to the clients. And the payback period is is not that long as it was before. In addition, so our solution, it's hard to tell you what's the payback. It all depends on the certain location because the price of the electricity is not the same in Nevada and California. It's completely different, very different. So the payback varies from the state to state, but it's not that much of the payback. It's much about the application that can provide, because our solution is definitely designed for the remote areas where there is no power access. We don't require expensive and long construction work such as digging trenches, underground wiring, connecting that with the power grid. Those are the most expensive part of any streetlight installation, and we don't have that.
Well, that's pretty amazing, and I'm really excited to hear about all these advancements. You know, Las Vegas, Sin City, is not thought of a sustainable area. Why did you pick Las Vegas to pilot test this idea?
Well, the city of Las Vegas is actually going very aggressively toward sustainability and renewable energy sources. City of Las Vegas actually have a plan to be completely powered by renewable energy sources when we talk about utility and public lighting. Of course, we cannot power all casinos with renewable energy, but definitely some public utilities definitely can be, because Nevada is a great source for renewable energy. They have almost 300 days of the sun, so it's a great potential. And we had really good conversation in partnership with the city of Las Vegas. It was a very smooth project in terms of bureaucracy. As you know, many cities, they put too much procedures, too much bureaucracy in front of any project. In case of Las Vegas, city of Las Vegas, I must say that we had very good communication and partnership. And in 10 days, we literally conclude this project, and we started moving forward right away.
Well, the human-powered streetlights aren't the only things you produce. You also do smart solar benches. What makes these benches so smart?
Well, these benches are also provide energy and are designed to be installed in parks, city squares, other locations. It's not just it can provide different features such as charging mobile phone, Wi-Fi access, but it also harvests many outdoor data that city officials can use for many different analyses. And having the right data is, we think, it's critical in order to make wise and productive decisions. And those benches are a tool for the city to harvest those outdoor data while providing very useful services to people.
That's Peter Mirovich, CEO of NGO Planet, telling us about their smart streetlights powered by human footsteps. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is Green Sense.
Green Sense Farms, the largest network of commercial indoor vertical farms in the world, wants you to join in our green dream. You can now own a piece of the farm with our limited time equity offering. You'll be promoting sustainable farming by investing in our transformative growing technology. Visit our Start Engine campaign at greensensefarms.com.
Desalination, the removal of salt and minerals, especially from seawater, is a process already being done in some parts of the world. But could it be part of the answer to our water crisis? Here to tell us more is Rick Stover, director of the International Desalination Association. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
How much seawater is desalinated globally?
Well, seawater desalination is a well-established utility in most of the world. About 300 million people, some or all of their water supply comes from the sea.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Can you give us a breakdown of what desalinated water is used for?
Well, everything from drinking water to industrial water requirements. So pretty much every product that we use requires water for its manufacture. And increasingly, that water needs to be purified. So seawater is desalinated, and brackish water and wastewater are also desalinated. In the United States, the U.S. is the second largest in terms of desalination capacity, and the vast majority of it in the U.S. is for industrial use, for example.
And when they desalinize water for industrial use, is it cleaned or purified to a lesser level than potable drinking water?
Well, it depends, right? You usually treat the water to the extent that you need it treated. The most common process for water purification and desalination is reverse osmosis. And generally speaking, reverse osmosis gives a very high purity water. Regardless of the water that comes into it, a high purity water comes through as permeate.
One of the troubles with reverse osmosis is it takes all the cations and anions out of the water. So do you have to further treat that water for both drinking and industrial processes?
Right. That's so reverse osmosis, as you say, will take out a lot of the ions that otherwise stabilize the water. So what's common for municipal water supply or for tap water is that desalinated water gets remineralized before it's put into distribution. So that means typically calcium and magnesium are added to the water, and that keeps it from doing things like rusting the pipes on the way to your home.
Well, Israel's a leader in desalinization technology, and they generate a portion of their drinking water from the process. So why is Israeli technology so advanced in this area?
Well, you're right. The country of Israel, the last estimate I saw was that about two-thirds of the municipal water supply is desalinated. It comes from the Mediterranean Sea. And one of the reasons that the Israelis are so committed to desalination is because they really don't have an alternative. There's big reservoirs or mountains that water, fresh water flows down from. And so they've had to be audacious and build some of the largest desalination plants in the world. That said, a lot of the components of those plants, including the membranes and the pumps and the energy recovery devices, were developed and or manufactured in the U.S.
Well, that's good to know. So they just have a much bigger demand and need over there. They're in a desert, so that's right. Pretty obvious.
The Arabia, around the Caribbean, around the Mediterranean, North Africa, country of Australia, a lot of China. A lot of countries rely on desalination, not just Israel.
How much desalinization are we doing in the U.S., and how much more can we be doing?
Well, there's really only one large seawater desalination plant that's operating on pure seawater in the U.S., and that's in Carlsbad in Southern California. And that plant started operation, I think, a little bit more than a year ago. However, as I said, the U.S. is the second largest user of desalinated water, the vast majority of that being brackish or groundwater. So not as salty as seawater, but a water that has enough salt in it that it needs to be removed. And like I say, primarily used for industrial uses.
Rick, walk us through the desalinization process and tell us how it works.
So what's involved? So there are a number of ways to remove salt from water. The predominant one, the one most commonly used these days, is called reverse osmosis. And it requires a semi-permeable membrane and a pump. So you push water through a membrane and the water filters out the salt. So that's the most common process, and it's used everything from a relatively small scale underneath your sink to enormous scale plants big enough to serve well over a million people.
So what happens to the material that's waste from that process, and what is that waste?
Well, so the reverse osmosis process, or any desalination process, is a separation process. It separates pure water from the salt water, so the residual is a more concentrated salt water. If you're doing seawater desalination, that's typically done at about 50% recovery. It means you're concentrating the salt up to a factor of two, and then that salty stream goes back to the sea, typically. So other processes concentrate it more, and there are other things that are done with the residual. It can go to the sewer, for example. It can go to an evaporation pond. It sort of depends on the local situation.
And can that salt be recovered and used in an evaporation pond?
Right. In some cases, that is the case. Brine mining, so where you're actually extracting minerals from the salt water. There are a number of minerals that we get from the sea. And in this case, it's much more advantageous to start with concentrate from a desalination plant than it is to start from raw seawater.
How does it compare to the treatment of surface or groundwater from a traditional water treatment plant?
Well, times are changing, and so it's a bit of a moving target, the answer to that question. It used to be that that fresh, clean, drinkable water came flowing out of the mountains and right down into the river running in, through our backyards. But with increased drought and climate change, increased population growth, and increased demand, it seems like everything we do is requiring more and more water. We've had to resort to worse water sources, wastewater, seawater, for example. So it really is a matter of necessity. What we've done with desalination over the last 30 years is to dramatically reduce the cost to operate it, in particular, dramatically reduce the energy required by about a factor of four in the last 30 years, making it much more economical.
How does it compare?
So it really depends. There was a study done in Southern California evaluating the possibility of putting in a seawater desalination plant in either San Diego or Los Angeles. And the cost of that was compared to the current cost of getting water from primarily comes from the Sierras. And what was understood from that was that a seawater desalination plant would require slightly more energy, only about 20% more energy than the energy required to pump the water all the way down from the mountains. But there's really no way to compare the cost because the existing method of the big California Central Valley Canal can't be duplicated or expanded. There's just no way we have the infrastructure to deliver water in the old-fashioned way.
What are the environmental benefits of desalinization?
Well, of course, the primary benefit is that you get water. And what we've done as an industry and as technology is to reduce the environmental impacts associated with that. So, for example, it used to be the way you did desalination was with distillation, meaning you just boil the water. We've developed reverse osmosis, membrane separation technique that requires one-tenth or less of the amount of electricity or the amount of power required to desalinate with distillation. And so there's been a benefit in terms of environmental impact in going to this technology.
That's Rick Stover, director of the International Desalination Association, joining us on GreenSense. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of GreenSense. We'll be back next week with
Tom Appel, our old friend from Consumer Guide Automotive. He'll have a look back at the year in green automotive news. It was a big year for that. And also, it was a big year for political divide. But one thing that brings people together, especially this time of year, is food. So we'll have someone from Slow Food USA. And Merry Christmas, everybody, by the way.
Now you can catch every GreenSense show. Just visit our website at greensensefarms.com or view the list of radio stations that air our show so you can listen terrestrially. Send an email to robert@greensenseshow.com if you want to contact me. Our goal here is to be an honest broker of information so that you can make good decisions. We hope our guests have inspired you to action. Now it's your time. Do your part. No matter how small an action, you can make a difference. Stay fresh. Keep innovating. Because when you're green, you grow.